pense que beaucoup d'entre vous le connaissent. Mark Raykel a été un des pionniers du développement de la tomographie à émission de positons et également des principes qui ont ensuite abouti au développement de l'imagerie par résonance fonctionnelle. Et en fait, Mark Raykel est un de ceux qui s'intéressent depuis quelque temps à cette question du basal, de cette activité en dehors de l'activation, si vous voulez. Et justement, on va voir en quoi cette activité qui n'est pas liée directement à l'activation spécifique ciblée sur une tâche peut être intéressante dans le contexte de la discussion d'aujourd'hui. So, Mark, if you may come up to the stage. The title of Mark Raykel's presentation is Two Views of Brain Function.
Pierre, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here and to participate in this most interesting meeting, which for me is actually extended beyond the walls of this room into many interesting conversations with the participants in this meeting, which I've enjoyed immensely. As I think Pierre said, because I'm linguistically challenged and don't understand French, I am from the world of brain imaging. And so the perspective that I want to share with you is heavily influenced by that, and a lot of what I'll show you comes from that. But I hope you can take away the notion that what I have to say will extend beyond that. So what I want to talk to you about is this idea that maybe there are two ways to think about the brain. In one view, which dominates virtually all neuroscience research, whether it be imaging or neurophysiology or cell biology, is that it posits the idea that the brain is primarily reflexive and it is driven by the demands of the moment in the environment. Obviously, it's easy in some ways to design experiments around this. You ask your preparation or individual to do something, and you look at the result, and then you try to interpret what happened between what went in and what came out. The other view is that the brain's operations are mainly intrinsic, involving the maintenance of information for the interpreting, responding to, and even predicting the environmental demands. Now, these two views are not the least bit new. They're certainly not mine. They go back at least a century, if not more. And the issue is, how does one adjudicate the relative merits of these two views? And that's the proposition I want to share with you. So let me give you the view from the world in which I live of the first view of the brain. That is, it's a reflexive input-output system. Now, imaging, as we understand it, began in the early 1970s with the invention of X-ray CT, followed shortly thereafter by positron emission tomography, which allowed us to begin to look at the function of various organs, and in particular the brain. It took in vivo the whole technique of autoradiography and allowed it to be done safely in humans. And then in 1980, MR appeared on the scene with its gorgeous anatomical images of the brain, and in 1992 we began to map the brain with so-called functional MRI or magnetic resonance imaging. And as this talk proceeds, I will say more about how those systems tell us about what the brain is doing. But for the moment, just keep in mind these are the tools. But having those tools was not enough. We had to have, I think, an approach to the behavior. And I'd rather like this a diagram of the kind of recent historical perspective of this enterprise. It comes from a talk by Bruce Alberts, then president of our National Academy of Sciences, in which he pointed out that you can have two disciplines, say in this instance something like neuroscience, which develops over years and divides into all of its subdisciplines and flourishes in its own right, and then, in this case, social sciences that do very much the same. But the major steps forward in the creative process is often where there are intersections between two somewhat seemingly disparate areas of research. And I would submit that the important step came when systems neuroscience, using imaging techniques, began to work with people in cognitive psychology who had an information processing approach to the dissection of human behaviors. They fit beautifully together. And this enterprise began to flourish, as I say, initially with PET, but now with MRI. It has gone well beyond cognitive psychology. All of the social sciences, in one way or another, are now beginning to participate in this. We have specific disciplines now, like neuroeconomics, with their own societies and journals looking at decision making. We have neuromarketing, which is even patented. If you had an entrepreneurial interest in this, you might want to be cautious. And I'm leaving this meeting to attend a meeting of the MacArthur Foundation on the intersection between neuroscience and the law. So it is affecting and appearing in all aspects of our life. For us scientists, it's in the journals. For you who are not scientists in this audience, it appears in the popular press almost daily, if not weekly. But it's more than that. What I think is very heartening is the interest that images such as this have generated among neurophysiologists in terms of the neurophysiology of these signals, the cell biology, which in this instance Pierre Magistretti has contributed in a seminal way, and even, much to my surprise, the genetic aspects of images like this, a development that a dozen years ago I never would have anticipated. So it's a huge agenda, and it's based in large measure on this first view of the brain as an input-output system. And to give you just a slightly additional impression, I'm sure the scientists in this audience are familiar with PubMed. It is a searching service that allows you to get a sense of the world's literature. And if you were to go to PubMed, as I did in April, and just ask functional magnetic resonance imaging in the brain, you'll come up with about 10,000 citations, and about 13,000 if you put PET in it. So something close to 25,000 papers have been published using this approach to understand how the brain works just in the past 15 years. So this has enormous momentum. And the question is, is that going to be all there is to it? 25 years from now, there will be 50, 100,000 papers following the same line of reasoning. And I would like to hope, or at least I hope, before this is over, you pause and think about that. I'd like to begin by saying something, and again, if you know this, I don't mean to insult anybody's intelligence, but to remind you, the brain is only 2% of our body, and yet it consumes 20% of all the energy in the body. Now, the question I have is, do these things, which appear in our scientific publications and the press, account for that? Both those that we systematically induce and those that you have just sitting here in the audience. Is this what there is to it? I think not. This is an old paper that we published in Nature in 1988, looking at the brain's processing of single words. And what you have here, these happen to be PET, the nose is here, the left ear is over here, and these are activity images, not difference images. So this is the activity within the brain, in this case blood flow, but it could have been metabolism. And each row contains a different activity all within the same 19 subjects. And I would just ask you to look at this, and even knowing what these people were doing, ask you if you can see the differences in those images. And I would strongly suggest that if I hadn't told you what was there, you might not even know where to look. But I would be very surprised if you could confidently tell me where things are happening. And yet this is what was published in Nature in 1988. Now that's crude by today's standards, but this is typical of the kind of things that are going on here. Those changes are exceedingly small in terms of what the brain is actually doing. So that which we ask you to do and that which you produce changes the overall operation of the system that's in your head in very, very small ways. So this brings one then to the question, should we take more seriously the alternate view here, that the brain's operations are mainly intrinsic, maintaining information, interpreting, responding, and predicting environmental demands? Well, the first question one might want to ask is, where does this cost come from? I mean, what's costing so much here? So let's have a look at the energy budget. If you just take this little gray zone as the changes that we induce and look at the rest of this, what you find out, without going into any of the detail of this diagram, is that the cost arises from the transactions between pre- and postsynaptic neurons and adjacent cells like the astrocyte, that it is the movement of things like the excitatory neurotransmitter glutamate that account for 60 to 80% of the running of your brain. And that translates in my world into the input and output of neurons. The conversation going on within your brain continuously accounts for up to 80% of the cost of running the brain. And the additional burden of talking to the environment is within a percent or two of that. So I think one has to conclude that the brain is heavily dominated by its intrinsic functional activities. Now the problem is, how do we study this? Because all of a sudden you want to ask the question, what is it doing when I don't ask it to do something? And that presents a problem. People have listened to the brain and looked at the brain all the way back to Berger and noticed that there were intrinsic activities ongoing in the EEG and in electrodes that are placed by neurophysiologists. I want to give you a perspective from imaging, which is not the only way to approach this, but it's one that I think may be helpful to you understanding my position here. One of the things that we were confronted with in the imaging world was not only that when we asked you to do something, we found areas of the brain that increased their activity, as we would have expected. But we began to notice that when we asked you to do that, there were also areas of the brain that decreased their activity, as if they were doing something when we didn't ask you to do something. There was much discussion about how to interpret this, but to jump over a lot of the interval science that came up with the notion that these were basically intrinsic organizational activities that were not simply increases in activity that somebody had missed because they did not conduct their experiment carefully enough. And it led us to coin this notion of a default state of the brain, which has become associated with this particular set of areas, but I would submit it is the behavior of virtually all aspects of the brain and all of its systems. Now, this gave us a clue that there was an intrinsic, large-scale organization of the brain ongoing at all times. But again, this kind of data, as much as it was present in our largely everybody that did this in their work, it was somewhat limited in what you could do with this. There's been into speculation about what areas like this actually do. But there was another development that occurred, and largely unnoticed for 6-8 years. And that was that in the signals that we monitor in the brain, as is true of almost every biological signal that anybody has ever made, they're noisy. And if you put somebody in an MR scanner and you simply ask them to open and close their eyes and you look at what happens in the visual areas of your brain, you can see these undulations in the activity that you would anticipate. And you also notice how noisy this signal is. And the common strategy was simply to average that signal until the noise went away and you saw these beautiful curves that go up and down. And that's how we, to this day, make our measurements. But the question is that really noise? Is it important? Does it have a role in the operation of the brain? And it was an MR physicist by the name of Bharat Biswal at the Medical College of Wisconsin who asked a very simple question that if you placed a region over that part of the brain that's concerned with the movement of your hand and say, ask simply, does that norm, that noisy signal, is it related to anything going on in the brain? And to the surprise of Biswal, I am sure, and to everybody else who has ever looked at this since, that indeed it is. So if you place a region over your left motor cortex and you ask, is it correlated with anything ongoing in the brain, and you're laying there not doing anything, what you find most remarkably, it is correlated with the other motor cortex. They are simply going up and down together. If you look at this in an image, these are MR images, and you put a region here asking, what is that correlated with? Remarkably, what you see all the way down into the cerebellum is basically the underlying organization of that system, which is coherently fluctuating at all times. And you can march down through the brain. You can do this in the visual system, and you can even see areas of the visual system like the lateral geniculate nucleus. And then an observation made by Mike Grecius at Stanford University that caught our attention and got us seriously interested in this was placing a region here, and you may recall from two slides before, this so-called default network. If you place a region there, you see that entire network, and you're simply laying there doing nothing. This is the network I showed you earlier. If you look at the activity here or here, spontaneous, no task involved, you can see how coherent those fluctuations are. And if you simply put a seed here or here, you can see that coherence reflected in the underlying functional relationships within that system. And one can proceed then throughout the brain and identify systems in this way and virtually map both cortex and subcortical structures. But one of the things that was also interesting, if you noticed in passing, that there are other areas that are anti-correlated with that system. So again, what you just saw, but here are these areas in blue. And again, if you've looked at these kinds of images and know this work, you may identify those areas as part of what's called the dorsal attention system, a system of areas that is involved in your activities when you're addressing in an attentive way events in your environment. And as I've indicated, when you do that, these areas decrease their activity. And yet that relationship between those two systems is manifest in anticorrelated behavior in the resting internal properties of the brain, as if recapitulating all the time these relationships. This can be extended, and I won't get into the details of this, well down into subcortical structures. You can start at the cortex and go down and basically identify the major nuclei of the thalamus in the same way that I've just described. You can do this in animals, and we had an interest here. This is in monkeys, published in Nature a year ago. And again, you can see in the ocular motor system, a system in the monkey brain that is well known to neurophysiologists who have studied it for years, has this same coherent behavior even under general anesthesia. And if you wake two of these monkeys, so these are 11, you wake two of them up and you ask them to perform an ocular motor task and you look at it with fMRI, you can see the correspondence between the evoked and the spontaneous activity. And you can see using retrograde tracer techniques how well it corresponds to the underlying connectional anatomy of that system. You can even look at this in humans where you have the corpus callosum both intact and cut. This is in a study that's of full section of the corpus callosum, which, as some of you may know, is used in the treatment of intractable epilepsy. And this was a young individual whose brain, which you can see here, was anatomically normal, and the patterns of coherence are very much as I've been describing. And yet, when the major connections between the two hemispheres are sectioned, you basically have two coherent intrahemispheric sets of areas. So one question that comes up then is, what is the cell biology of this? Why is it that we can put somebody in an imaging device and actually see this kind of thing going on? And I need to say just a little bit about what the signals are that we look at here. When we stimulate your brain, say with a checkerboard like this, and compare it against seeing nothing, what we know is that the blood flow in your visual cortex goes up, but surprisingly, the oxygen consumption doesn't change very much. That was a big surprise physiologically. And as a result of that, you're simply delivering more oxygen, and the oxygen availability in the brain goes up. And what's interesting about that is that changes the properties of a magnetic field. So if you're in an MR scanner and blood is coursing through the arteries and veins of your brain, as it loses oxygen, it disrupts that signal. But if we increase the blood flow, we increase the oxygenation, as we did here, and you get that signal. So these are importantly interrelated changes that are very dependent on this arrangement here. But what I want to call your attention to, because it's central to the points I want to make, is that blood flow and glucose utilization, in fact, go up together. It's a key part of this observation that I would submit has received far less than is due. So if you look at how the brain uses glucose now, independent of burning it up to CO2 and water, you find that it is very much involved in getting the transmitter glutamate out of the synapse. Pioneering work done by Pierre Magistretti and his colleagues have shown that this pump that gets the sodium out that enters is purely glycolytic. And there's good evidence to suggest that some of this change in glycolysis is due to the removal of glutamate from a synapse and the pumps that are initiated thereafter. But it's also true that the same enzymatic machinery that does that kind of work is also located in the postsynaptic density. And to this, I want to call your attention. This is a remarkable structure that contains all of these channels, receptors, and signaling protein structure that is an enormously dynamic process that is going through renewal and change almost by the minute in our brain. And the argument I want to make here is that the changes in glycolysis in some ways are reflecting not only what's going on in an astrocyte, but what's going on in here. Now, for some of you who either didn't take biochemistry or took it and regretted it, I apologize for using this slide, but I also apologize to my colleagues who know this better than I do, because for both of you, I'm not going to give you the full story. But I just want to point out that when glucose goes down, the common way in the world that I live in was to think glucose to pyruvate, burn it up to CO2 and water and be done with it. And the thing that is important to remember is that it has a completely different life, if you will, that involves DNA, RNA, lipid membrane system, synthesis, protein phosphorylation, getting rid of oxygen species in the brain, in part related to the redox state. That little glucose molecule is deeply important to your brain, in addition to helping out with energy. And it's something that I think we need to be paying far more attention to as we move forward. We know that we don't have to provoke your brain to do something. In fact, it is always a bit glycolytic. And if you look for a map of this, what you find, interestingly enough, it matches up very interestingly in prefrontal cortex and along the midline, both with this default network and what in our world has become control systems
There is something peculiar, even at rest, about certain systems in the brain utilizing glucose in its many guises, and I think it's deeply important to understand what that might be. And I want to give you just a few examples of how we might begin to think about this. There are some interesting things in development, sleep, and learning, and I'm going to touch on them very briefly. A number of years ago, a neurologist at UCLA by the name of Harry Shigani had the opportunity to measure brain glucose metabolism with PET in young children being evaluated for surgery for epilepsy. This was a pioneering endeavor that produced, I think, incredibly valuable data. And what Harry Shigani showed was that when you come into the world, your glucose metabolic rate begins in the first couple of years to rise to a level that is about the adult level at age 2 to 3. And then surprisingly, at about age 8 to 9, your glucose consumption in the brain is almost twice the adult level, and then falls back over the next decade or so to the adult level. And this is pretty true of pretty much all the areas of the brain and even in subcortical structures. And the question is, what is this all about? And he posited that it related to the proliferation of synapses and cellular elements of the brain, and then their pruning over time subsequent to that. The critical piece of data that's missing here is how much of that glucose utilization was glycolysis and how much of it was energy use. But what we do know is that when you enter this world, about 30% of the use of this is just glycolysis alone. And if you happen to come into this world a bit prematurely, it's almost 100%. So your young brain is highly glycolytic, and the question is whether it becomes more so as you call upon the processes that glycolysis serves in the development of your brain. If we turn back to this default network and look at its functional connections, that is, how coherent are its components over time? In children, the left to the right hemisphere, the width of these lines reflects the coherence between sides, is quite strong, but the front to back is quite immature. And as you grow, these connections largely going front to back begin to mature. And I use the word connection in a purely functional sense here, because the wires are in place, and yet the strength of the relationships is plastic over time related to experience. What's also interesting is that this process in aging reverses itself. So as you cross 60 and enter the decades in which I live, these connections begin to change in the reverse direction. You lose the front to back. So if I seem slightly incoherent, you will understand. Sleep is also an interesting issue here. Our interest in this was stimulated by Giulio Tononi at the University of Wisconsin, who has come up with this very interesting idea that during the course of your wakeful experience, you have a proliferation or potentiation of the synaptic structure of your brain. And then as you sleep, choices are made and it's returned to a baseline, a new baseline state. And the question is there a cost function involved in this? And he persuaded me with this picture that maybe we ought to think about this. If you go to bed at night and you just simply look at the blood flow to your brain, it is about 20% higher overall than when you wake up the next morning. In slow wave sleep, it drops way down. REM sleep is kind of partway between. But the point to be made here is there is an absolutely remarkable change in just the blood flowing to your brain varying with your sleep-wake cycle. Now, a 20% change in the cost of running your brain is a serious business. This is a paper that was, I find, really remarkable, and I think it was largely ignored by me and my colleagues. This group was interested in the fact that if you go to sleep at night, as you sleep, your consumption, total body, of glucose drops precipitously during sleep. Total body. And the question that these investigators asked was, what accounts for that? And what was most remarkable is, it's your brain. The implications here being that as you enter sleep, here's your glucose metabolic rate and the oxygen consumed, and it drops over the course of the evening sleep, both oxygen and glucose. But what's really striking is the percentage of this that is glycolysis, and it takes a precipitous drop. So you enter sleep with an augmented use of glucose, which drops during the course of the night. In somewhat of a whimsical fashion, while I was recovering from jet lag sitting in my room here, I wondered if, supposing you didn't sleep, what would be the cost of this? And I asked myself, could this possibly be why you must forget? So the data I just showed you are these first two points here, and I took the probably outrageous liberty of extrapolating these curves into 4 days of not sleeping. And what you encounter is that the cost of running your brain becomes prohibitively high. You cannot afford this kind of increased cost, which has to be related to these underlying cellular molecular events, which come with a cost. So whether it's consolidation or reconsolidation, it doesn't come free. And therefore, as we do in our life, our brain also must make choices. Finally, the issue of learning. And this, too, is a part of our collaboration with Giulio Tononi. But it is presaged by a lovely experiment, again, looking at the whole brain and doing a typical cognitive activation experiment, the Wisconsin card sort test. Unimportant, but difficult. And what these investigators, Scandinavians, observed for the whole brain was just what we had seen always, that the blood flow goes up, the oxygen consumption doesn't, and the glucose consumption does. But what was deeply important about this study was when it was all over, the glucose consumption stayed up. Now, I realized this morning, this is what's called the oxygen-glucose index. So, when this drops, glycolysis is up, and I didn't have time to change it. But the point of the matter is that glycolysis went up with the experiment and then stayed up as long as they could measure it. But this is for the whole brain. So the question then is, what if we could identify, use a paradigm, and look explicitly within the areas of the brain affected by the task? This is a task that was developed by Tononi and colleagues, Alice Ghilardi and others in New York City, in which the object is to simply take a mouse in a scanner and move the cursor to any one of these circles surrounding this central point when it is identified by increasing its luminance. So you're sitting there, all you have to do is a target's identified, you just go out and back and you've got this mouse on a bit pad. Now, unbeknownst to you, we impose incrementally a deviation in the movement of that mouse cursor, such that by the time you have finished the experiment, there is a 60-degree deviation in the movement of that cursor, but by doing it in small increments, you're totally unaware that we've done this to you. And of course, we can show during the course of this that your directional error in various levels of rotation improves if you compare the first 16 trials to the last 16. And as you move across the entire experiment, you have now covertly learned this. Now, if you compare this covert learning with a control experiment in which no deviation is imposed upon the subject and ask first in an fMRI experiment what areas reflect that learning experience, you find that in prefrontal cortex in particular, but some other areas as well, These are the areas that can be identified as being affected by having learned this covert motor task. Now, what was particularly of interest to us was the second experiment in which we measured all the metabolic parameters with PET, had you learned the task, put you back in the PET scanner and remeasured them, asking, is there a metabolic trace related to this experiment learning that has any bearing on the anatomy of the task? And I have to say, I was quite surprised. Highly significant changes in these areas here in terms of the persistent ongoing glycolysis. Now, the obvious question is, what if you went to sleep, got up the next morning? The prediction would be you won't see that because there has got to be some changes. But at least persistent in terms of hours, it was there. So if you look at the persistent glycolysis in the covert motor learning experiment, and you look at the levels of resting glycolysis in the brain, well, I think it's probably at this point a bit of a stretch, but I would point out that the changes in glycolysis fall within the anatomy of the brain that is persistently glycolytic to begin with, raising the question that these areas not only are concerned, of course, with covert motor learning, but any experience that you're having during the course of the day. And looking at this kind of anatomy, which would suggest that these areas may, we don't know for sure, have a special role in this. If you then take this region that's identified and look at going back to these functional resting connections in the brain, you can see an anatomy. These are the areas that this area here is talking to all the time. And if you then go over to an overt semantic learning paradigm that people like Ian Dobbins have pursued, so now you're not talking about covert motor learning, but you're talking about an overt semantic task in which you're learning something, I'm struck by the fact that these anatomies are very similar. So within systems that seem to be concerned with learning, one begins to see the emergence of changes that could logically be related to these synaptic dynamics and the cost involved. So do these things vary in interesting ways? I think they do. Do we understand them in detail? Of course not. But I do think they offer us opportunities to think creatively about this. So in the course of this, what I've tried to introduce you to is this notion of two views of brain function. One that looks at it as an input-output system, and one of them that looks at it as an important intrinsic system. I think the weight of evidence, purely from a neuroeconomics point of view, would suggest that the intrinsic activities of our brain are dominantly important in how the brain works. I was thinking of the things that I was hoping you might carry away from this talk, and these are a few of them. The brain's costly. The cost is due to its function, not housekeeping, and it relates to the input and output of neurons. The cost of the intrinsic activity far exceeds evoked activity. Wakeful experience increases that cost significantly and cannot be sustained indefinitely. Sleep and forgetting, using the word forgetting loosely here, is therefore a necessary consequence. And as I was listening to Christina, I was thinking, does the brain have a finite information capacity as one of the limiting issues here? And that finite capacity is in part determined by the sheer cost of running it. Then I tentatively added this, is understanding intrinsic. And the several dinners have indicated to me that whatever word I choose here is likely to be controversial, but I put non-conscious activity is critical to our understanding of evoked or conscious activity. I close with this quote from William James when he was talking in his principles about perception. He said, enough has now been said to prove the general law of perception, which is this, that whilst part of what we perceive comes through our senses from the object before us, another part, and it may be the larger part, always
comes out of our own head. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark, really, for this enlightening presentation. Juste un commentaire pour... je crois que Marc a très bien mis dans le contexte de cette journée, notamment avec cette dernière diapositive, donc l'existence de ce système intrinsèque qui est actif en dehors de tâches précises, évidemment ouvre à la possibilité de ce système étant impliqué dans des processus inconscients et donc à quelque chose qui, évidemment, est au centre des discussions d'aujourd'hui. Donc voilà, j'ouvre la discussion. Question ? Oui, madame ? Ah oui, Susan, ok.
Tononi's hypothesis about this synaptic depression during the role of sleeping, the synaptic depression, is interesting, and he has some data to support it, but it is not the only one. And there's a very large literature showing that indeed during sleep the brain is very, very active, and that there's the theory is that there's a reactivation or a replay of circuits that takes place, and this is an ongoing offline memory consolidation. So it would reinforce what you say about intrinsic activity of the brain being very, very important for function, but it doesn't really go along with the idea that the role of sleep is for forgetting or synaptic depletion. So can you just make a comment about reconciling these two positions?
La question à voir avec le rôle du sommeil. Bon, comme Mark Raker l'a noté, peut-être ben, cette homéostasie synaptique, c'est-à-dire de l'oubli en partie, ou en tout cas du réaménagement, par rapport à la notion que le sommeil sert à consolider les souvenirs.
That question causes me to think about the word forgetting. Because we all know, I think, that when you learn something before you go to sleep at night and you wake up the next morning or you even take a decent nap, you're better after having experienced that. So the concept of forgetting here might be more a question of somehow or other understanding how choices are made concerning these arrangements. And I think this is where the work Christina was talking about becomes so valuable in understanding how this is negotiated. You do have to make choices. And my guess would be, in a very simple, superficial way, you're making choices that your brain considers optimal. So forgetting, I won't use that slide with that word in it again, but I have to think of the right way to say this, but I think you get the general drift of where I'm going. And that is that whatever wakefulness is in terms of experience and learning is an incrementally costly affair. And therefore, something has to change. Now, as you know, but didn't mention, that slow wave sleep into the Tononi hypothesis is a deeply important part of this. But where does REM sleep fit into this? I have no idea. Sleep is a very unexplored topic biologically, probably because it's deeply difficult to do it. It's hard to do our kind of experiments in sleep.
Richard Frakowiak.
Morning, Mark. I wondered whether you could explore a little bit this issue of the cost.
Yeah.
In terms of what happens in childhood and adolescence, where flows and metabolisms are possibly even twice as high as in adults, and also the issue of the reflexive component, which, as we all know, is small in relation to the underlying, as you've rightly pointed out. What component? Do you know what the latest figures are on the component of brain metabolism, total brain metabolism, that is due to neuronal as opposed to housekeeping, glial, and other activity? And does that have any impact on your theory?
Richard, peut-être tu peux résumer la question en français. Je pense que tu es capable de ça.
Bon, je demande, ma question se relève du métabolisme augmenté chez les adolescents et les enfants, quasiment deux fois de ce qu'on trouve chez les adultes. Et deuxièmement, quoi qu'on comprend très bien que l'augmentation du métabolisme focal réflexif qui soit petit par rapport au métabolisme global, je demande aussi, est-ce qu'on connaît en ce moment la proportion du métabolisme qui est dû à l'activité neuronale par rapport à l'activité gliale et d'autres activités cérébrales?
Now the trick is, do I remember the question? The issue, Richard, having to do with what is the cellular, what within the cells is costing here, and this is a huge subject of which much work has been done, but it clearly, the weight of evidence in my estimation relates to issues at the synapse for biophysical reasons, if nothing else. It's just moving ions and the like, and you have a very large surface to volume ratio, which makes the cost go up. But which cells are important? I think it's obvious that the glial cell is important in its own right, the astrocyte in particular, which is a deeply important cell, not just getting glutamate out of a synapse, but maybe even governing how synapses are developed and formed. And as some of you know, astrocytes remarkably actually release glutamate into that synapse. The other mysterious player in all of this, of course, is the inhibitory interneuron. And I think this is an underplayed story. Oftentimes when I give a talk like this, I look at cost from a pure balance point of view, because whether a neuron fires or not is dependent not on whether it just gets an isolated kick to do something, that is an input from another excitatory cell, but what its ambient level of activity is, which is determined by the balance between the inhibitory and excitatory. And the degree to which the balance of that system is costing in its own right is a total unknown. But balance is not just a neuronal thing. As neurologists, as you and I know, if you see a patient, for example, with a lesion in your frontal eye fields, you get deviation of eyes to the side of the lesion, reflecting balance even at a systems level. These are things that are, I think, deeply important, and we ought to be attending to that. With regard to the teenager, I must say I am troubled by the lifestyle of teenagers. I was reading in the New York Times coming over here, there was an article about the fact that in some of our most prestigious prep schools, these young folks are so busy that they don't have time to eat and live on limited sleep schedules. And I think when we begin to think about the importance of sleep, and the fact that the brain cannot sustain itself if it doesn't get adequate sleep, ought to factor in to the lives of these young people whose brains are developing. We know that if we keep a rodent awake continuously, in a few days, the rodent dies. And my guess is it's because the brain is exhausted. And I think it's a tragedy if we do that to young people when their brain is developing.
Alain, ici.
Thank you very much for this beautiful talk. What is the? You have insisted on the role of metabolic factors in this default. Now we know that in the resting brain there are these permanent oscillations. Multiple areas in basal ganglia, thalamocortical loops, etc., which are permanently present in the brain. What is the role of this oscillatory activity in the default system? Alors, la traduction en français. Nous savons qu'en la traduction en français.
Oui, si tu es.
Nous savons qu'en permanence dans le cerveau, il y a dans toutes les boucles du cerveau des oscillations qui sont permanente même pendant le repos. Et quel est le rôle de ces activités oscillatoires, des rythmes spontanés dans l'activité du système default?
I don't have an answer to your question, but I think it's a deeply important question. The first thing that I think confronted people who observed this
And it goes back even well before Bharat Biswal. It goes back to people in the 1950s and 60s looking at coherent oxygen waves in rodent brain and things of this sort. It's been known for a long time. It was to get beyond the issue that it's an artifact. And I think that deeply concerned a lot of people that it was related to slow oscillations in respiration or slow cardiac output variations and things of this sort. I think we have to accept that if it does contribute, that is a small component. For example, in the callosotomy patient, when you cut the two hemispheres apart, you reduce the shared variance by 90%. This is after making attempts to correct for artifacts, so that at upper bounds, this system may have 10% noise that is related to the heart. But to extend my comments just a bit on that score, if our behavior, and we now know this to be a fact, contains variance that is related to these slow oscillations, then why would not some of the slow oscillations in autonomic functions like heart and respirations be equally affected by this variance? The question is, who's talking to who and telling who what? And I think in part in getting an answer to that is important. But much more fundamentally, I think what we need to do is to move from these measurements of metabolism and circulation that come from the imaging world and get them connected with the underlying neurophysiology and cell biology here. I think this is absolutely critical. And it, again, forces a new approach to the neurophysiology to begin with, because people, you know, with increasing number of electrodes impale various parts of the brain, and first it's 10 neurons, then it's 100, and then it may be 1,000, but it's still in one spot. And I go around trying to convince my neurophysiological colleagues to put another set of electrodes somewhere else. And let's get to the bottom of this. Are these up and down states, changes in cortical excitability? And if so, how are they mediated in such a large systems context? Finally, they're unique in one regard, I think, but where this is still to be determined, that whereas things that are, for those of you familiar with it, things called gamma band coherence, high frequency coherence and association. So when I engage in a conversation with you, and if you could monitor pieces of my brain, you would find that high-frequency activity recorded in the tissue becomes coherent locally within the brain. But the minute I quit doing that activity, that coherence goes away. Meanwhile, these slow oscillations continue, and if we put you under general anesthesia, they're there. And it's now been clear that if you go to sleep, they're still there. So there's some fundamental biological process being expressed here, and we're limited in understanding it at the moment, partly because it was unexpected.